Welcome to the Abnorm Podcast, episode 88, a podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
I'm Stu.
And I'm Jerry. So this is a very special show for us. It's our first ever predictions podcast. So without further delay, let's get on with it.
And that is indeed a very special predictions episode. So obviously we have a sort of back channel. We talk about what we're going to be doing. And Stu suggested that we mimic some of our preferred, our favourite podcasts, in that we're going to try and do a predictions episode this episode. And then hopefully next year we will come back and review all of our predictions, assign points and stuff like that. And I've taken a bit of a lead from the Bad Voltage podcast, and I've come up with this set of rules. So obviously, if any of our listeners think that I'm doing this completely and utterly wrong, please let us know. But so, Bad Voltage podcast, obviously, there's a few very strong individuals in that group, and they like to barter for, they like to battle each other for points.
That was pretty funny this year.
It got down to
sixth of a point or something.
Yeah, we're not going to do that. We're not going to subject our dear listeners. Well, I say that I'm very competitive, so I probably am going to be like that.
I think we're going to use integers, not floating point.
Yeah, definitely. And definitely no fractions. Okay, so the rules are very simple. Each prediction must be measurable and quantifiable. Each prediction, if correct, will score 1 point. There will be 3 main predictions per host. Each host may include 1 or more bonus predictions, but they will only score a point if there is a tie for first place on the main predictions. And each host will list their predictions in their entirety. So each host will read all of their predictions out, including any bonus predictions, before the next host is asked to provide their predictions. Hope those rules make a lot of sense. So we're going to start with Stu, as he's our most recent addition to the team. So Stu, over to you for your predictions.
Thank you. So my first prediction is based upon AWS's usage of the Graviton2 processors, which are the ARM-based chipsets. And my prediction is that the Graviton2 is going to become the default option when launching either an EC2 or Fargate or ECS, and potentially even EKS, which is their Kubernetes offering. So right now, if you go into AWS's console and go to launch an EC2, which in AWS land is a virtual machine, by default, it will have a radio button checked as x86. My prediction is within the next year, that default will be on the ARM64 processor instead. The reason behind this is RDS right now, which is their managed database services, by default, they are now using ARM. I can't find the article about it, but I'm pretty sure I read somewhere that their Elasticsearch side is also either by default that or going to be default that. I could be wrong on that one. I'm sure I've read it somewhere, but yeah. And also, they've made a lot of noise about it recently to say, you know, this is the greatest processor since sliced bread in their account, and they've put a lot of marketing material behind it. The other side that makes me think of this is companies like Honeycomb, for example, have come out and said, we've moved all our infrastructure over to ARM, and the costs have come down by 40% for running the exact same workloads. So I predict within the next year, ARM64. And I think partially also due to the whole Apple M1 side, and a lot of developers using Apple now with the new ARM processors are going to potentially be targeting ARM as well. I think that's going to push the defaults to ARM instead.
Do you think there'll be an ARM64? Because Raspberry Pi is not ARM64, right? So do you think there'll be an ARM64 board like that that you could develop on and then maybe?
Actually, since the Pi 3... they've all been ARM64.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think the default Raspbian images, if you download them, are usually 32-bit, but some of the other ones are 64-bit, so I've done that on... Mm. I've got Raspberry Pi 4 that I've reinstalled stuff on recently to turn into a GitLab runner, and Ubuntu do 64-bit ARM for that, and that's what I installed on that one. It's working fine.
So what that basically means is anything that you can run on a Pi, you can run in the cloud. It's easy enough to... install something on an ARM64 image or an x86 image from a sysadmin point of view. It's just string replacement, basically. But yeah, no, that's interesting because you know, you build exactly on your Pi what you're going to run in the cloud.
Yeah, I think the only thing that's potentially going to hold this back is the access to ARM64 workstations, which I think now that, you know, Apple's obviously changed that a little bit now, and, you know, they seem incredibly popular already. I get the feeling that that's going to push things that way. And as I say, I think AWS already trying to do everything as much as they can on the managed services with ARM. I get the feeling that they're also going to push the defaults that way as well. And then x86 will actually have to be a configurable option rather than the other way around.
I did read something in the last couple of weeks that suggested that AWS was actually one of the largest purchasers of M1-based kit.
Apple are probably making money out of licensing the M1s, maybe. I don't know.
Well, no, because the M1's custom silicon.
Right.
So although it's licensed from ARM, it's custom silicon created by Apple for Apple.
Who was it that bought ARM?
It was NVIDIA bought them recently.
Yeah. So there's that.
I don't know if that... I think it's still going on. Mm. I don't think it's completed yet. The M1, I know I've definitely seen there's a massive shipment of M1s that have been supplied to AWS for deployment into the cloud. And effectively, like you said, if you've got the Graviton chip as your default selection for AWS, for EC2, and if you need to go bare metal, like you can get bare metal or virtual machines on AWS for most of the instance types, I do think that you'll start to get M1. You'll start to see that a lot more often as an instance type will be the ARM CPU from the M1. So yeah, we'll see what happens with the, because I think you're right. I think up until now, a large proportion of people have been looking at the ARM CPU architecture and thinking, like many of us did, you know, oh, it's just good enough for netbooks, it's just good enough for mobile devices. And I think I've seen quite a lot of commentary that said, you know, the M1 has blown that out of the water, because it's quite clearly competitive hardware equaling or greater than speeds that you get with x86, or x64 rather. So we will see.
But isn't it too about power as well, though, isn't it, kind of thing?
Yeah, big power differences as well. I don't know the exact numbers, but yeah, it's massive.
So it's going to be basically offered to people in cloud environments for cheaper. And so people will just naturally go with the cheaper thing, which provides the same performance. So.
Yeah. As I mentioned, Honeycomb, they were ones that came out and said, yeah, our costs are down 40% by using the ARM-based chipsets in AWS now. So I think it's almost a no-brainer for most companies. Yes, there'll be some that are still requiring x86, but yeah, if your workloads don't actually, you know, matter which architecture they're on, they just need to run, I don't particularly see much of a use case now for x86 and AWS. I think it's probably better to go the other way.
Yeah, and probably on the back end, so the actual services that are offered, so, you know, the AWS's services might well already be running on ARM, because all they have to do is present a, you know, an API or something.
Yeah, exactly.
So it doesn't have to be x86, you know, it's decoupled.
Yeah. And the way that all hangs together as well is that they have what they call service contracts. So, like you said, because it's all API-based, as long as service A exposes a certain API set and service B exposes a certain API set, the two of them can just talk to each other over, you know, REST or whatever protocol that internally they're using, as long as that API contract remains. And so then when you want to move from service A to service C, for example, service C can either implement the same API as service A, or they can have it effectively as we will swap from using service A's API to service C's API. Prediction 2, Stu, what have you got for us?
This one's a little more out there on it, but I reckon within the next year that Oracle or IBM's cloud is going to gain enough market share to be included. So we won't be talking about the big three anymore. We'll be talking about the big four, which one of them I couldn't say for certain. From all my research on this one, the closest looked to be IBM's. But everywhere I could find market share on it, it was something around 2.8%. So my reckoning is within the next year, they'll hit something like about 4 or 5%, at which point they are in the same kind of realms as, you know, GCP at that point, at which point they can be considered as the four clouds rather than the three, as it traditionally seems to be at the moment.
As in like a cloud provider, as in like Azure or AWS?
Yeah, so whenever you're talking about cloud providers now, you know, your first option is always going to be AWS in terms of who you think of, then Azure's the one that most people think of next, and then usually it's Google's platform after that. I get the feeling that IBM, more than likely, out of the two, maybe Oracle would be the ones that come up as the big four.
How about Alibaba?
So I think the only thing holding that one back is Alibaba are already seem to be there, but no one seems to be considering them. And I think it's just because they're not US-based, unfortunately. No one seems to include them in a lot of the market share reports and that kind of thing. So they just don't seem to have the mind share because of it.
So there's an interesting thing around that. The company I work for is regularly touting the fact that they are in, you know, various quadrants of the Gartner Magic Quadrant. And effectively, it's really hard for a non-US company to get into the Gartner Magic Quadrant because they are primarily focusing their sales material to US businesses. I have heard anecdotal comments from various vendors that outside of the West, Alibaba swamps EC2, Azure, and GCP by a large margin. It's absolutely massive outside the US and effectively outside the Five Eyes because they've got more points of presence in local territories. So why wouldn't you go to those services?
Interesting.
Do you want to clarify that in the interest of...
That's a good point, yeah. So Five Eyes is a term used to describe the intelligence agencies in America, the UK, Canada, Australia and New Zealand. That's the Five Eyes. And in the last year or so, you've started to see Japan and I can't remember the other country. I think it is someone like India, but I might be wrong. So they're starting to call it the Seven Eyes because effectively what happens is the five countries all sort of share intelligence information with each other. That's why they're called Five Eyes, because they've got the Five Eyes looking at the various different intelligence streams. But yeah, it was almost a misstep actually mentioning Five Eyes, because that's not what I meant. I just meant the Western countries. So, you know, Germany, the EU, effectively UK, as we're on our way out, sadly.
Hey, let's not get too political.
Sorry. North America, Canada. These countries all tend to operate and act in a very similar way. But yeah, I think you know, China, Japan, Taiwan, even India, and some places in Africa, I think they tend to use Alibaba a lot more than we think they do.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I guess it because it doesn't turn up in the tech news, you don't actually see it unless you're, you know, actually working in it to a point.
Yeah.
The Wikipedia page seems quite good, assuming it's true.
I hadn't heard of it before you said about it. I saw like some, like, sounds like Alibaba was like some place you'd get random stuff like Wish or something.
Well, the reason I know about it is because there's a Terraform provider. So I saw it in documentation because it starts with A. And I just thought, oh, okay, that's the... And then I, you know, did 5 minutes, 10 minutes of research on it and just that's all I know about it. And I know there's a Terraform provider and you can probably build stuff, you know, similar stuff to where you might build anywhere else in Alibaba.
So I think the backstory for Alibaba as a cloud host and AWS as a cloud host are two very similar things, because actually, as I understand it, and I might be wrong, I'm not focused in that region of the world at all, but I do believe that Alibaba is a selling site like Wish, like things like that, that effectively had to build their own set of data centers to support the amount of customers they were selling to, and then ended up reselling idle capacity, much like AWS did.
Yeah, because AWS came about because they had loads of the servers idle for most of the time, so they thought, "Oh, we'll just use those and sell them to people."
Yeah,
sell that spare capacity and let everyone else have a share of it. That's a bit overly generous to Amazon, maybe, but
Well, I mean, you know, it's this cloud provider, and they redefined what people think of as cloud provider style hosting.
Rather than Oracle or IBM, I'd like to see like DigitalOcean, because in terms of, you know, user as a user, as a sysadmin, it's just, that seems like a good balance. Their way of doing things seems quite simple and not too complicated, not too simple, but a good balance between features and simplicity, really.
Yeah, I think the only issue with DigitalOcean is, I mean, I use them for my own infrastructure and everything, but unfortunately, I just don't think they're big enough to take on Oracle and IBM at the moment. I would love to have seen them in the same conversation as, you know, AWS and Azure, but yeah, I just don't think they're big enough, unfortunately.
I mean, if there could be a common API that speaks to all cloud providers in a kind of, the all the things that all cloud providers give you, you just present an API for those. Maybe I shouldn't have said that on there.
New startup next week.
So that's your second prediction, Stu. Let's move on to your third.
So the next one is based upon Microsoft releasing Winget recently, which is still in development, but it's their version of a package manager. However, so far, the package manager is more about installing. It doesn't have the ability to delete included packages and things like that. I think that within the next year, there'll either be an acquisition or at least rumblings of an acquisition of Choclity, because they basically provide what Winget is supposed to be doing already. And Choclity, it would basically make Windows almost Linux-like for the people that want to use it like that, whereas I think Winget has a way to go on that. So my prediction is Microsoft either acquires them or builds a very heavy partnership with them and starts including it almost as the base install on most of the server images and things like that.
Fair enough. Any commentary from the audience?
I'm not sure. Well, it depends. If people choose the Windows way over the WSL way, then that's what it depends on, because if you have WSL, you have a Linux command line and you've got, you know, apt and go and, you know, all this other stuff, which you don't necessarily need in Windows, if you know what I mean. It depends. Maybe a new generation of developers will use the Windows tools. Maybe that would be how it happened. But all the stuff that currently exists in Linux, and which, you know, is the reason that I would actually prefer to have a Linux desktop for work rather than the Windows desktop running WSL, it's already there in Linux most of the time. And it's not there in Windows unless Windows is running Linux.
Yeah, I mean, this is more coming from the idea of, I know Windows, or at least the Kubernetes side of things, they're trying to involve more on the Windows side. And if they're then having to run Windows subsystem for Linux on top, there's not really much difference from running Linux anyway at that point. So if they're trying to push more on that side, I am wondering if they're going to make it a bit more like Linux in terms of how you manage it, but at the same time not having to use Linux to manage packages on there. So, I mean, I've done a little bit with it recently to install a few dependencies, and it's a lot easier using Choclity than, you know, going off and finding random features and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I think this one's probably a bit more left field, and I don't know. This is the one I'm less certain of out of the other ones, but yeah, if they start, I don't want to say get bored with Winget, but just start realizing the problem that they've got, they're going to have trying to get this in there, trying to get it as, you know, as idempotent as you can by being able to, you know, install and all that kind of thing, and, you know, install without having to, you know, check what packages you've already got, that kind of thing, and be able to delete stuff. As I say, Choclity's already got all of that already, so I don't know whether they bring people across, whether they just, or whether nothing happens, I don't know. If they do want to go that way.
I think it'd be a good move.
Yeah.
I mean, even you could even have, you know, so anecdotally, I had a thing the end of last week where we were trying to get this IPsec tunnel working. Is that something that could be done with Choclity? Just like installing a Windows configuration, maybe registry keys or that kind of thing?
Not really, no, because basically just as Stuart says it's just so you can store dependencies, really. Well, whatever you need to store to configure the machine, like we're using to like put on things as we like Notepad Plus and stuff.
Can you do like the group policy type stuff?
Yeah, but that's all done. But if you've got a policy, you wouldn't need to do that for Chocolatey. So Chocolatey just installed, or it's a way of saying. But
if you haven't got an Active Directory infrastructure, then you can't necessarily, you know, if you can install it using packages rather than actually being connected to an Active Directory infrastructure.
They do have the ability to create your own Chocolatey private repositories now, kind of like an enterprise version, at which point I suppose if you created your own packages that included the configuration elements, they might be possible. But that would involve more work on someone's side. I'd be more thinking along the lines of, you know, just, again, config management, like, you know, we talk about with Ansible and things like that. You know, Chocolatey already there that you can make use of. Or, you know, so if they start making more use of things like Cloud Init to bring things up, I mean, I know they've got their equivalents, you've just been able to say, you know, package install whatever, rather than, you know, having to go off and start invoke web request to get, you know, an exe file kind of thing, if they can have a package manager and use it like that.
Can you do that with PowerShell at the moment? With Winget? Is that?
Yes.
Is that with Winget? Yeah. Okay. I haven't got that far into Windows. I've just been using the minimum amount of Windows.
So I know that in the past I have used Chocolatey, and there's another thing called Box Starter, which is almost like a wrapper over Chocolatey, where you can have it run certain commands from like gists or whatever, which can include things like, you know, regedit, run these commands, PowerShell these commands to put registry keys in, perform actions that you would perform in your normal run-of-the-mill PowerShell stuff. Absolutely, Jerry. It's definitely the sort of stuff you can do. And the other nice thing, just changing the subject ever so slightly, what Al was saying before about using Chocolatey to install packages and stuff, if you want to go to boxstarter.org, you can actually go to something like boxstarter.org/package/ and then a comma-separated value list of all the packages you want to install. And it will basically just install the whole lot for you from just one URL, which is a really nice way of installing stuff.
And also you can use Ansible with Chocolatey as well, which is quite cool.
I didn't know that. Okay. Yeah, that is quite cool.
So you basically just say, you say you've Chocolatey, then you want these applications installed, and it just goes on and does it for you. Obviously, there's limitations. Like, I think if you want to have a private repository, you then have to start and make your own ones. You have to start, that's when you have to start paying for it. Also, as well, like, things like I had problems like if when Google Chrome updates the check some changes, and then it can cause issues with that kind of thing. But I mean, I've been using Ansible to basically just do all that PowerShell command stuff for you. So we do use group policy, but we then obviously when we first configure a machine, I like to just using Ansible because, you know, it's just the way you know that you can just follow those steps to make sure that all those steps have completed correctly. And then my next thing is looking at is obviously once you've done all that, it's in having a tool which then goes back and then obviously then checks that all those things you've configured is configured correctly, isn't it? Kind of thing. That's my next kind of challenge I'm facing. Because obviously sometimes the PowerShell script failed or something. If you don't put exit codes in or whatever, then it could silently fail and you don't know it's failed. So that's my next, looking at how you verify your server is configured, how it's meant to be configured.
Test-driven development.
Yes, test-driven development is exactly what you're talking about. Okay, we've gone on quite long on that one as well. So, Stu, bonus predictions. Do you have any bonus predictions for us?
I do have some bonus predictions. These are ones that I think are potentially unlikely, but kind of getting them in just because it could be fun. I suppose one of them's not fun, but fun to see some of the others. So the first one, and given what I said about the big four cloud providers potentially at one point, given Google's history of everything, I would not be 100% surprised to see them announce a shutdown of Google Cloud Platform at some point this year. And I think that's unlikely, but I also wouldn't be entirely surprised to see it.
This is based on them cancelling Google Reader and, you know, the backlash.
Yeah, I still cry about that myself. So, you know.
Yeah.
I took the opportunity to self-host Tiny Tiny RSS and haven't looked back since
same.
I sadly lost Google Reader.
Yep.
Okay, so that's your first one, is that you think Google Cloud Platform will be shuttered.
Yeah, I've heard rumblings that their execs are trying to get more money out of it and wondering at what, you know, is there any point keeping it going because it's not doing the exact thing they want right now, which, unfortunately, I hate to say it, Google have a history of going, this isn't doing exactly what we want right now, just shutter it and move on. You know, Google Reader being a big example of that, and Google Plus to a point as well, and... Yeah, Wave.
I was going to say Wave.
Yeah, pretty much every attempt at a chat platform they've had in the past 10 years as well. I cannot list them. I don't have enough fingers to count off at this point.
There's the website Killed by Google or something like that, isn't
yes.
there?
Yes. And yeah, I would not be entirely surprised to see GCP added to that at some point. My next bonus one is, we were talking about the ARM side of things and Apple M1 briefly earlier as well. I think Apple's M1, they will make available in cloud, not just as bare metal, which AWS have now just done with Mac Minis, but I think they will be able to use the native hypervisor kit on there to be able to offer Mac-based VMs in something like AWS or one of the other cloud providers. Probably AWS at this point is my biggest guess.
So supplying AWS with the chips, basically, or the servers?
Whether they do it as servers or whether they just, I mean, right now they basically got racks and racks full of the Intel Mac Minis, so they can offer Macs as a service, but it's bare metal right now rather than VMs on there. I think they'll take the M1, possibly the Mac Minis, or there may be something else that Apple comes out with soon. I think they'll be offering Mac-based VMs as EC2s, not just bare metal, and again, on the M1 architecture.
So, well, sort of subcontracting to AWS, why not just run their own data centers and do it that way?
I suppose mindshare at that point, just, you know, if you're going to a cloud provider, you're going to go to AWS, you're not going to go to Apple for your VMs. I mean, again, Apple are, you know, just as likely to start it themselves and not allow anyone else to do it because they have history of it.
That said, I do believe that Apple are one of the few actually legitimately multi-cloud companies. So they've got equal workloads in AWS, Azure, and also GCP, if I remember rightly.
Is that by design?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's by design.
So in case one goes down, it's basically redundancy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, as I say, I think, you know, for whether it's, you know, a continuous integration platform, whether it's developing iOS apps, but, you know, being able to sign it within Xcode on a Mac VM that's elsewhere rather than having to rent out a full Mac, which is what they tend to be now, that's my prediction for that one, that you'll be able to take a... whether it's an EC2, whether it's an Azure instance, if it was Microsoft that ended up being the first one to do it, you know, that'd be very different from what you'd have seen, 20, 25 years ago, but at the same time, be interesting to see. But yeah, I get the feeling something like that is going to come along at some point in one of the cloud providers.
So I've just had a quick search whilst we've been talking, and apparently Apple is one of AWS's biggest customers, my apologies. So it's predominantly AWS that they use.
I'd dare say they'd have the ability to bring something up in GCP or Azure if they had to.
Yeah.
Even if it's just by hiring the however many contractors it takes to get it done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they seem to have hired half the Kubernetes community recently. So yeah, they'll probably have half the cloud community soon as well.
Fair enough.
I'll move on to my last one, which is, I think this is going to be very out there, but it will be quite nice to see, which is a major cloud or host provider. So whether we're talking, you know, your AWS's or that kind of thing, or just a hosted provider of the realms of DigitalOcean, Linode, something like that, announcing OpenPower or RISC-V availability as VMs or bare metal. And I think this is the least likely one to happen, but it'd be nice to see if it did.
Mm-hmm. It's quite an interesting one.
Because I know there's some of the RISC-V development boards are starting to get out there, so I'm wondering whether that will be part of it as well.
Well, that is a very interesting selection of predictions there. Any of those that you think are particularly likely to happen, or do you think it's all equally not possible?
From me or from everyone else?
From just you.
From me, I think the Graviton2 one, I'd be very surprised if that doesn't happen, where it becomes the default for pretty much everything in AWS, and x86 almost becomes a option you have to request rather than the default. The rest of them, I think, are a bit less likely. IBM Cloud becoming the fourth cloud provider, I think, is probably next most likely. The rest, I'm kind of just throwing things out there, seeing what sticks to a point, I guess.
Fair enough. Right, well, I'll crack on with my set of predictions. So my first one is that I think there will be a significant data breach at one of the top web properties, either Facebook, Google, Apple, Microsoft, or Salesforce, which will result in an article on the BBC News website. So I'm being very specific about these. One of those five companies ends up with a BBC News article. Okay. And it's specifically going to be a data breach. It's not going to be it's down an acquisition or anything like that. It's specifically a data breach.
Interesting.
I mean, I like that idea. I like not that everyone's going to have their data breached, but that it's going to be people's data is collected by these companies all the time. And the fact you say it'd be a data breach implies that there will be an unscheduled departure or copying of data from, you know, one of these companies. Whereas, you know, all the time there's a flow of data from people's activities and posts on Facebook and location and all the rest of it to these companies, and they just going into like a black box and being sold on to who knows what by who knows where and who knows what. Maybe the fact there is a breach and the data's maybe publicly available will be a good thing.
Part of where this prediction's come from is that over the last probably year or so, there's been a change in the way that most ransomware operates. So whereas, you know, we're all aware of things like WannaCry, which is where the ransomware virus that was spread that infected like large swathes of the NHS and things like that, where that all they would do is they'd encrypt the system and then request payment to decrypt it. In the last 6 months or so, there's been a big swing from the ransomware operators, where they used to just say, give us your money and we'll unlock your files, to they've now started changing that model quite significantly, actually, is that they're now saying, pay us this much money, and if you don't, we'll release it all with plain text. So they're doing an exfiltration of all the data, then they're encrypting it, and then if you don't get payment to it to decrypt it, they're then sharing it either for free or for charge. And that's happening more and more. So that's actually where I think that's going to come from. I think there's going to be some unsegmented part of the network at one of those big providers that's going to get popped, and it's going to lead to a massive data breach. Anyway, that's my first prediction. My second prediction, and this one's definitely a bit more of an out there one, is that Microsoft will announce a publicly accessible server operating system based on Linux, either alpha, beta, pre-release, preview, or will release it during 2021. So that's not necessarily saying that you will be able to get it on that day, but as you know, there will be something that will be announced in 2021 that will be a Linux-based operating system from Microsoft.
And not just in Azure.
And not just in Azure. It will be something that you can run on your system, on a system in your data center. It's not going to be one of their routing, because obviously some of the software-defined network that lives inside Azure is running on Linux. I think it's actually going to be an operating system that where they replace the NT kernel with a Linux kernel.
Be interesting if that's the replacement for CentOS in future.
Huh.
Yeah. Might even be based on CentOS.
Yeah. I'm inclined to agree in a certain sense, because I'm thinking that slightly more towards the Azure side, but Amazon have Amazon Linux, but actually now you can download that yourself.
Yeah.
At minimum, I reckon there'd be an Azure equivalent to that at some point, which, you know, whether it's based upon CentOS or RHEL or something similar, but your ability to download it yourself, I think I would count that as well at that point, because it's generally available. But yeah, I think I agree with that, actually, yeah.
Okay. So that's my second prediction. My third prediction is that HashiCorp, the company that produces Terraform, Vagrant, Vault, those sorts of tools, will be purchased, or the intention to be purchased will be announced by either Amazon, where it will become their replacement for CloudFormations, or will coexist with CloudFormations, or by Microsoft for Azure to live alongside or replace ARM templates.
The interesting thing there is I almost put that as one of my predictions as well. So I definitely agree on that one. I think it's going to be AWS on that one if I was going to be betting on one side or the other.
Yeah, I think so.
That.
But I was hedging my bets a little bit with that one because I think it's a little bit too specific to say HashiCorp's going to be bought by AWS. I think we've all seen the number of times that prediction shows have said, Ubuntu's going to be purchased by Microsoft. So know that one's not too easy to say it, and it's too hard to see it actually be delivered. I think HashiCorp's going to be purchased by AWS or by Azure. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. So that's my main set of predictions. Any commentary on those three before I crack on with my bonuses?
Just a comment on Canonical being purchased by Microsoft. They may not have been purchased by them, but they probably a good proportion of their income might come from Microsoft or certainly a contribution to the project. Maybe not financial, but...
I don't know. I think there's definitely a couple of heads inside Canonical that are paid for by Microsoft. But as to whether or not it's a significant proportion of their money, I don't know. I think they are still reasonably well done by the community who purchase support from them. I think that's still their main earner. That and data center operators.
If so, they're really the sort of the only open source company that's operating like that, really, because Red Hat were until they were bought by IBM, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose. Well. I was going to say open the SUSE, but have they been acquired again?
Wasn't it Attachmate or something? Or it was some company that you wouldn't associate?
Yeah, I mean, it might just be funding rather than, you know, that, but I don't know if they're entirely independent anymore on that side.
But yeah, I think you're right. I think they are the only fundamentally independent open source operating system company. Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. Right, bonus predictions. These two are, one's wildly optimistic and the other one is, I guess, also, they're both aspirational predictions. So the first one is that Matrix will replace, generally, Discord as the de facto gamer chat service.
Oh.
Aspirational, yes. Likely to happen, probably not, but I wanted to put it out there as a thought to put in people's heads. Now, I know that people like Chris from Jupiter Broadcasting, Alan Pope from the Ubuntu podcast, they both said that the standard client element has some UI problems that make it less intuitive to people, and that if you try some of the other clients, it makes more sense. But yeah, I think there's a strong possibility that Matrix could replace Discord. Now, I did say that everything has to be measurable and quantifiable. I'm struggling a bit with how to quantify this one. But so I think the number of people that... See, I can't even say that. Oh, I'm going to have to... I think I might have to backtrack on this prediction because I can't quantify it. I think I'm going to have to withdraw. I'm going to have to withdraw my bonus prediction. I'm going to have to say it, isn't it? I can't have that one as a prediction. Oh no. Okay. Right. A quantifiable one. I can definitely quantify this one. IPv6 adoption will increase over the year of 2021 by at least 5%.
Is this going to be to do with the surging Bitcoin price?
No, I think this is just the natural progression of IPv6 adoption. I've seen some of the graphs. So you can there's graphs that Google produce based on how many people address Google properties from IPv6 addresses.
That's probably a very good indicator.
Yes.
In the same way that Backblaze is a good source of what hard drives perform well and so on, because they use so many of them.
Yes.
And Google uses so many packets.
So Google currently have, I think, so the last set of figures that I saw seemed to imply that it was about 33% IPv6 traffic to their services.
That's higher than I expected it was, actually, but yeah.
I was thinking it was about 15%. But yeah, 30%, 33% I think it is. And predominantly that's coming from mobile networks.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because most of the mobile networks are IPv6.
Yeah.
And probably most of the hosts on the internet are on a mobile network.
Yeah. Yes. One thing I did notice when I was in Boston with my old workplace last year, and I was on a Verizon connection there, and that automatically had an IPv6 address. So actually some of the big providers in America are already getting behind it. And I know there's, you know, big changes here with a few different providers. Sky have had it for a few years. BT are in the process of it. Virgin aren't, which is unfortunate because they're my ISP, and I'd quite like to have native V6 at some point again.
The reason the mobile network's getting behind it is because of LTE, which apparently LTE to do the VoIP. So LTE replaces analog voice with a voice over IP system. So your phone actually terminates a voice over IP call. And that requires IPv6, apparently. So that's why the mobile networks have gone IPv6. So EE is definitely IPv6. O2, I think, is IPv6. Vodafone is IPv6. And if you do get an IPv4 address, it's usually carrier grade NAT.
Yeah.
So it's not a real IPv4 address. It is a real IPv4 address, but look, consistently it's an IPv6 address that will be the one that you'll be talking to the internet from. And then they tend to go through an IPv4 gateway on the boundary of their network. So those are my predictions. How about we go around to Al?
Sounds good to me. So, going on the base of the ARM again, I think HPE or Dell will provide an ARM-based rack mount server running EXA ARM Fling, and it will be released to manufacture code and not in beta.
Ah, interesting. I know I've seen Lenovo have done an ARM server recently, but not HP or Dell. Interesting.
Yeah. I'd like to see them, like, because everyone's talking about it in the cloud, aren't they, kind of thing. So it'd be quite good to see what HP or Dell will do on that phase. I mean, their main platform is 86, isn't it?
Mm.
That's my first one. My second one is, it's quite comical after what happened last week, a major cloud provider, i.e. as in Google, Microsoft, Apple or Facebook, will have an authentication outage lasting more than 6 hours, meaning that no one can log into that service.
Well, we've already had the precursor to that, as you've already said, yeah.
Yeah, that was quite interesting because we, at work, we use kind of Google as our main, because we're a American company. Yeah, we were kind of kicked out of everything, which is quite interesting. So, and my next one is kind of, think one of the Abn podcast hosts will have FTTP to their house by the end of 2021.
Oh, now that is a good one.
Because I've been quite surprised at how a lot of, if you buy a new house, do you have to provide it? They provide FTTP, BT OpenReach. But I was speaking to someone last week and they are seem to be pushing fiber to all the poles in quite a lot of towns in the UK, which is quite interesting kind of thing. And my final bonus one is Abn Podcast will have its 100th podcast published by the end of 2021.
Ooh.
Oh, that's...
I think...
So you should all be able to, whatever you're saying, you verify those hopefully by the end of next year.
100th podcast by the end of next year. I guess that's feasible.
Yeah.
It might actually be our December episode.
We might have to do 3 episodes in one night just to actually do it. It's more of a challenge now than anything, I think.
Challenge accepted. So, do you have any bonus predictions, Alan?
That was my bonus prediction, was the one about the 100th podcast.
All right.
And the classic of Conical will get brought and it'll be the year of the desktop. But we can't have those because we can't clarify them. That always seems to be the, isn't it, what they seem to say.
Yeah. The FTTP one, if it was available here, I would definitely be getting it. That's all I'm going to say. I don't think it is, and I'm not sure when it will be, but I'm almost guaranteed if it was here, I'd have it.
Given Virgin won't even run a fiber to my street, I think I'm likely to get that one anytime soon.
I think those are all quite safe predictions.
So, Jerry, round to you for your predictions.
Okay, well, at the start of this episode, I was a bit worried because I didn't have any predictions. My mind was blank. I hadn't really been thinking about, sysadmin IT stuff because I do that during work hours and it kind of takes all those brain cycles during work hours. Anyway, during this episode, I've come up with some predictions. So there we go. So I will start with, in the next year, I think a common API for cloud providers will come into existence and there will be a community in the same way that there's like Terraform and its Terraform providers. That kind of hints at a sort of common approach to speaking to these clouds, but that doesn't actually exist with Terraform. So my prediction is that there will be some project which gives you what all cloud providers give you. So for instance, I think all of cloud providers have a Kubernetes service. So, you know, there'll be a kind of middleware for that. All cloud providers give you, say, a public IP and a VM attached to a public IP. So something like that. I mean, arguably this stuff exists already, but you have to write the middleware yourself, I suppose.
So effectively what you're talking about is a standard API that would provision a host on AWS, and the same API call would provision a host on a virtual machine on Azure or on Google Cloud Provider.
Yes. Now, you've still got this notion that there's a plugin that has to provide these things for each cloud, and that has to be maintained. And yeah, so that's what makes it less likely.
I suppose there's potentially one interesting project that doesn't quite do that, but is almost has some of them goals, which is HashiCorp release something called Waypoint, which is essentially a way of saying, this is my code, run it. And you just do Waypoint up, and that will spin up either an EC2, it'll spin up something in Google Cloud, it'll spin up in Kubernetes, whichever way. So I'm not going to say it's a unified API, but it's a way of potentially doing something similar to that. But it looks to be more for, you know, whether it's containerized workloads, that kind of thing. I don't think it's as general purpose as that.
I think Chef has something like that as well called Habitat now I think about it, but I mean, I think it's very container-based because that is the easy way to do that, yeah. I suppose.
One analog to the networking industry is for about the past, I mean, almost as long as I've been was doing networking and actually got back out of it again, they've been pushing for something called Yang, which is essentially almost like a definition of what you want as a service on your networking gear. So whether that's, you know, I want an interface, I want a certain root protocol running, that kind of thing, you would define that in this Yang model, and then it wouldn't actually matter whether you was targeting Cisco, Juniper, Arista, Extreme, whichever way we go for that, your Yang model would work with all of them. So, but the unfortunate thing there is that's been about 10 years it's been going and it's still not ratified. So, yeah, well, I don't know whether that's good or bad for your prediction at that point. But to be fair, the networking industry usually takes a long time to agree on anything. So, yeah, maybe that's not the biggest barometer of whether that one is will be there or not.
Maybe this is an aspirational one because I'm not sure it'll happen in the next year, but, you know, there needs to be a better approach, I think, because then once you've got a common interface, the cloud providers just have to compete on what they can provide you, I suppose. If you can run your own services and you don't have to use theirs and you're just using a common interface, you're making them compete on other things than what they're actually providing and what gives the users back some control, I suppose.
Yeah, as I say, that's exactly the same arguments for the Yang model in the network inside. So, yeah, I think, I don't know whether there's going to be a repeat on that or not, but yeah, it sounds very similar to something I've heard before, put it that way.
Sure. Okay, so my second prediction is from something that I hope will happen, something I hope won't happen, Apple will hire all the ops people, all the sysadmins, all the cloud engineers.
So how's this going to be quantifiable? That's my only worry with this particular one.
Oh, okay. I might have to back out of this one. Maybe they'll get all those ops people that have been that just want a steady paycheck and no problems. And
I suppose, is there any particular ones in mind, you know, whether it's, you know, Kelsey Hightower or Charity Majors or anything like that? Is anyone in particular you think if there was these people, it would almost be an indication of it, I guess?
The kind of thought leaders, I suppose, isn't it? Yeah. It depends whether those people are hireable, yeah. I suppose, by Apple. Yeah, it's a difficult one. Should I give a personality that I think would be hired by Apple in 2021?
How about if you list three and it's got to be one of those people?
Okay, well, taking Stuart's lead, Charity Majors, Cory Doctorow. This completely makes it no. He won't go anywhere near Apple.
No. Okay. We'll stick with Charity Majors and, you know.
Charity Majors will be hired by Apple. I know. I can't stand by that prediction. No, I'm just going to go with Apple hire 50% of sysadmin type people will be working for Apple by the end of 2021.
Okay. I have no idea how we're going to measure this one. But okay.
We've got a year to work that out.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. We'll write an answerable playbook to do it.
I think you'd be best off saying, you know, one out of the admin podcast had a first week.
I think we're a pretty good representative sample.
I'm not hugely convinced by that one. Okay, fair enough.
Okay. All right. Anyway, that's my second prediction. Like it or lump it.
Okay.
And my third prediction, Linode will provide cloud in it. And sensible image storage. So this is my bugbear at the moment. Linode, you can't boot a Linode with cloud in it, and you can't, you have a very limited amount of storage, three images only, and the images have to be a maximum of 6 gigabytes. Yeah, you know, all the data in the image. It's not like a 6 gig disk. You can have a, you know, 40 gig disk with 6 gig used. So I think they'll start providing cloud in it to their customers, and they will charge you to store images, and loads of people will start using Linode and they will love it. And Linode will grow massively.
So that's your three main predictions.
Yeah.
Do you have any bonus predictions for us?
I do. And it's leading on from an earlier, in fact, it's probably stealing from someone else, but I think Microsoft will fork CentOS. Because CentOS has gone CentOS Stream at the moment. The open source version of Red Hat will be controlled by Microsoft.
Ooh.
Have you looked at what you... Because if... I don't know. If you, I think they've got their bags in Ubuntu too much. Because if you try and deploy a CentOS image in Azure, you can't. You have to pay for it.
There is a reason for that. And that reason is that the CentOS project were not in a position to release cloud images. So likewise, there's no AWS image of CentOS 8. There's only CentOS 7. There's no GCP cloud image of CentOS 8. There's only CentOS 7. The only place where you can get a CentOS 8 VM image is to run on KVM or effectively a local hypervisor. You can't get one for the cloud providers.
Oh, I just thought it was Azure you can do it, but obviously it's other providers as well.
No, so one of the things that one of our listeners, one of my colleagues, Mohips, produces is cloud images for our company to use as a sort of a gold brick image for any of our machines, and they produce Red Hat and Ubuntu, and one of their to-do items was CentOS, and they couldn't do it because CentOS 8 was not available on any of the cloud platforms. And actually, having heard some of the reporting around the new CentOS Stream stuff, there were only two people employed by Red Hat to work on CentOS.
Yeah, I heard that as well.
Total. And they just didn't have the bandwidth to do it. So that's why ultimately CentOS 8 never made it to any of the cloud providers.
Almost feels like it's been coming for a while, doesn't it?
Can't find people interested enough to work on it. I was thinking about this. A company that I used to work for, whose name I won't mention, they were running Red Hat and they weren't properly licensed. And this was a big company, you know, big worldwide company. So they got audited by, they got audited and were found wanting and probably liable to pay to owing Red Hat a lot of money. And so they built their own CentOS distribution. There's a sort of Skunkworks project to build their own CentOS-based distribution. In the same way that CentOS build their stuff, that was the distribution for a while. And then after maybe a year or so of that, they switched to Debian because it was just easier. But yeah, that's it reminded me of that because that's kind of what's going on at the moment. You know, there's questions about who might carry the CentOS torch, or, you know, basically recompiling the Red Hat sources to and replacing the artwork and so on, got licensing.
So I have seen that the original founder of the CentOS project has produced a version, or is producing a version, a new Linux distribution called Rocky, which is named for the person that co-created CentOS with him. So Rocky Linux will be the new CentOS. Well, is in the running as the new CentOS for those people that don't want to run CentOS.
It also makes me think, because obviously Amazon Linux is CentOS based or Red Hat based. So what's going to happen with that? Unless it's Red Hat based.
I think they maintain their own fork at that point anyway. There's some minor differences from CentOS, but yeah, I think they just maintain it themselves anyway at that point.
I mean, I think it's easy enough to do if you've got people to do it, or, you know, compute capacity to do it. You know, that's me being a bit hand-wavy. I wouldn't want to do it myself.
No, I would not be surprised to see quite an uptake on, Ubuntu, obviously, but also quite a lot of people switching to Debian for that.
Anecdotally, I've actually heard that people don't like snaps in their server OS.
Yeah, my last place was pretty much all Debian. They wouldn't touch CentOS. Just one of the guys that, you know, came up with a lot of the infrastructure just for whatever reason didn't like CentOS, preferred Debian, so everything was Debian there. And in my experience, it was as stable as CentOS was anyway, so I would not be surprised to see a lot of people move that way anyway now.
Isn't it more like with CentOS and Red Hat in the past, is it like it's like just set and forget, isn't it? Like you build a server to host an application and you don't change it for like so ever long, whereas like as in the cloud you're just building and stripping as quickly as possible kind of thing, and that's why people are using things like Ubuntu and stuff.
Another thing with CentOS is one of my clients is on CentOS 6 still, and the end of life was I think the end of November or the beginning of November.
Because I remember, because CentOS 6 was the first thing I came across before I knew about Ubuntu kind of thing, and it was just because we were just setting up and leaving it running kind of thing, and it wasn't one of those things you updated or whatever.
I have quite strong opinions around business support for operating systems, predominantly because I've been stung by the sort of 2 a.m. call on a few occasions, and you then find that you're not so appropriately licensed, or you haven't got the right level of support to get support at that time in the morning. And effectively, if you are a business making money from your servers and you are running those servers on CentOS or Debian, unless you have got the developer resource inside your company to support those boxes at 2 o'clock in the morning when they break, you shouldn't be using those distributions for anything that is classed as production. And effectively, the reason is that at 2 o'clock in the morning, you need to be able to pick up a phone and phone whoever it is that's providing support to your distribution and say, I'm currently losing X million pounds an hour. Yeah. Because I can't process transactions. And effectively, the only three companies that do Linux support that you can do that to are Red Hat, SUSE, and Canonical. And so I think those are the only three distributions that you should ever actually really be running in production.
So what you're saying is you're not moving to Arch soon then, yeah?
I was thinking, yeah, I better rethink those Arch servers I've got going.
Well, I mean, fundamentally, one of the reasons why CentOS was popular was because what people could do is they could build their fleet up with CentOS, and then once they'd got to the point where it was no longer a Skunkworks project, or it was no longer in pre-prod, it was about to go into prod, you run one command on your CentOS box, and it updates all the package repositories to point to Red Hat, runs an update, and install one package that replaces all the licensing stuff. So you could go from a CentOS box to a RHEL box with one command.
Was that after Red Hat bought CentOS, but they took over the CentOS project, didn't they? Because it disappeared for a while. It was like CentOS 5 was a long time coming, I think, back in the day.
Yeah.
There was a period when a new Red Hat version came out and then CentOS didn't come out. And then I think it came out and then Red Hat announced that they'd taken it under their wing.
I don't know.
I think I remember hearing that on like Linux Outlaws back in the day, you know, like maybe 7 years ago or something like that.
Yeah.
Seven or eight years ago.
I mean, CentOS has been supported by the company of Red Hat for years. And I think it was maybe 11 years ago that Red Hat bought CentOS. Maybe not quite that many.
I think I remember something like around 2012, 2013 or something, but I could be getting that wrong.
So yeah, so maybe 7 years ago then, perhaps. But yeah, they've been involved in the project for a very long time.
Yeah, it's just a lot of confusion for people right now, I guess. I mean, the whole thing where they pulled support and, you know, it's only going to be supported for another year now for people who've just upgraded to it. I mean, not that, you know, you're expecting paid support, but, you know, expectations have been changed, to say the least.
I mean, the one thing that I did hear from our friends on the Iron Sysadmin podcast, I think it was them, was that, you know, one of the potential focuses for this is that up till now, CentOS was cut after RHEL came out. So RHEL took the brunt of all the engineering effort for their paid product. And after all the brunt of the engineering effort went into RHEL, then CentOS managed to cream a supported workable product off the back of it. And one of the things they're suggesting might have happened, and to be fair, I should say, although Nate and Mark both work for Red Hat, at the time when Nate made that suggestion, he had been off work for a week, during which time that's when the RHEL CentOS thing all kicked off. So he actually missed all that lot out. What he said was that he thinks it's because what they want to do is CentOS will now be where people are running it almost as your guinea pig users. CentOS 8 streams will be your guinea pig users that will say, oh, there's a problem when you run, you know, foo in, you know, bar context. So it will be fixed in CentOS, ready for when they cut it live for RHEL.
Ubuntu does this, the sort of automated crash reports in a way. I mean, is that similar?
I would say this is probably more like the release candidate approach from what I gather anyway, where CentOS Stream becomes almost like we're just polishing this now and then it becomes RHEL. So it feels a bit more like, you know, let's say we're talking about Ubuntu 20.04, probably what it would be like in March rather than when it comes out in April. Maybe I'm way off on that one, but yeah, it's more like it's almost ready and we just need to apply the polish, and the only way we're going to do that is actually, you know, release it and have people using it and contribute back to it, which has raised the point that now people get to actively contribute from the community into RHEL before it hits RHEL, not afterwards, by running it on CentOS. But how many people are going to be running CentOS Stream in the way that they run CentOS before is going to be another matter entirely.
Yeah.
So with that, I think we're pretty close to the end of this one. We've had some quite... it turned into a much longer episode than I thought it was going to be.
But at the start of the episode, I didn't have any predictions.
I think it's fair to say we should start wrapping this up now. So I'd like to thank Dave for doing our audio production. He does a fantastic job each and every episode that we produce. He lovingly crafts it. He's an artisanal audio producer. So thank you very much, Dave. Your handcrafted wares are much appreciated by our audience. And talking of our audience, as you are an audience member, you may be interested to know that we are proud members of the Other Side Podcast Network. So you may want to find other similarly approached podcasts on the otherside.network. So if you go to otherside.network, you will find those other podcasts there.
I'd also like to thank all of the patrons who are helping us with creating this podcast and helping us keep it going, which is the list is Andamo, and we also have Andy, we have Dave, we have Maha, we have Mike, we have Stuart, not me, and we also have Yannick as well.
If you've got any feedback, you can send it to mail@admin.podcast.co.uk, or we've got a Telegram group like all the best podcasts. There'll be a link in the show notes, and there's a link on the website.
And thank again for everyone for listening, and we'll look forward when we come back in 2021, and we'll see if we get these predictions right or not. So we'll see you all soon. Bye for now.
Bye bye.
See you later.
Bye. Now it's over. I can open any door. Now it's over. I don't need you anymore. Now it's over. I can open any door. Now it's over. I never needed you before.
Been listening to a member of the Other Side Podcast Network. Find more about our shows at otherside.network.